Okay, so I'm very happy for the opportunity to address the joint Math Physics K Theory seminar. So last week, Joe Polchinski gave you a lightning introduction to string theory, and in particular, he focused on the physics of D-brains and the way in which the gauge fields living on D-brains can carry charges for lower-dimensional D-brains. And the focus of my talk today will be to explain in more detail how this leads to an interpretation of D-brain charges in terms of K-theory rather than in cohomology. So I'm going to compare and contrast. And I'm going to try and keep a little...
How do you lead to in the definition of the Chen-Patton bundle?
Let's see. Yeah, I mean, I'll sort of talk about that.
I struggle very hard by giving several literature material papers, can never get the precise definition.
Yeah, no, it's a, that's a great question. Okay, so I'm going to keep a little... So, yeah, and please, I really welcome questions here. So, now the idea that K-theory rather than cohomology should classify the brain charges is going to lead to some non-trivial predictions about the set of states in string theory, which one would not see, or at least not so easily, if one tried to classify brains by integer cohomology elements. So, so first of all, string theory contains extra D-brains above and beyond those corresponding to cohomology elements. And second of all, some of these D-brains carry, all the extra ones carry torsion charges, so charges which are conserved only additively mod n, and n is going to equal 2 in the case we'll discuss. And and there will be some missing brains, some brains which one would have naively expected from the cohomological classification of brain charges, which are actually not there in string theory, and K theory gives a reason why those are missing. Time permitting, well, time is not going to permit, so I'm not even going to say that. So let's first consider the simplest case, so that of type 2B string theory. And so type 2B string theory contains, among other fields, as Joe talked about last week, p-form potentials of even rank, which propagate in space-time. Those couple to D-brains of odd spatial dimension. Okay. And so these are the standard type 2B D-brains. Whose dimensions range from 1 to 9. Their charges are absolutely conserved, as they have to be, because they couple the potentials, and so it's necessary for the charges to be absolutely conserved to have the theory be consistent. So let's begin by talking about the D9 brain. Now, the D9 brain is a kind of funny object because it couples to a 10 form in the bulk. Right. So this is its interaction energy. This is the total amount of 9 brain charge, and this is the 10 form potential. Okay. And so since it couples to a 10 form, its charge must be absolutely conserved, and so you can think of it as a stable object, quote unquote. But this is a little deceptive, because if you vary the equations of motion can often be thought of as being derived from action principles. So in other words, the fields must be such that the action or energy for a static configuration is a local extremum under any infinitesimal variation of the fields. And so the equation of motion, and this is the only appearance of the 10 form in the action of string theory. And so the resulting equation of motion is basically just Q9 equals 0. So the total amount of 9 brain charge in the system has to vanish. So that means that you can have states with 9 brains and an equal number of 9 brains. But no 9 brains by themselves. And that's also not quite true, because there's another object in string theory which carries 9 brain charge called the orientifold plane. But it's present, well, it's something we'll get to a little later. Right, Q9 is not dynamical. It's a, basically, because Q9 is conserved, the time derivative of Q9 vanishes, and it's not even a localized quantity. It's an extensive quantity. It's the amount of, 9 brains are space-time filling objects. So it's it just vanishes. That's right, but it doesn't vanish a priori. It's just something which the existence of the 10 form sort of forces to vanish. So let's see. That's right. So if we want to consider sort of topologies of tachyon configurations living on 9 brain into 9 brain pairs, it suffices. We have to just consider the reduced K theory, K tilde of space time. Because the virtual rank, is that what you call it? Vanishes, right, of the bundle. So now this isn't quite the right K group for all of our purposes, though, even in type 2B. Okay, because let's say we want to consider completely spatially localized configurations, or configurations with a finite energy density. So that means that we want to consider bundles which are approximately flat, the connection which is approximately flat outside some compact spatial region, and so bundles which are topologically trivial outside some compact spatial region. And so the group we want to consider would be K tilde of X with compact support in the spatial directions, in all spatial directions. And similarly, so if we want to look at things which resemble particles, spatially localized things, this is the K group we look at. And then likewise, if we want to consider if we want to consider configurations which are extended in some number p of spatial directions, then we'll have to consider the K group, which is appropriately compactly supported in whatever normal directions you want to consider. So that is always just going to be assumed from now on whenever I talk about the K group.
Could you remind us the definition of asymptotically compactly supported?
It just means appropriately compactly supported. So for instance, the completely compactly supported K group is the group you get by starting out with vector bundles whose restriction to the complement of some compact region is trivial. And so if we want to look at sort of one brains, we'll want to consider the K group you get from vector bundles whose restriction to the complement of a tubular neighborhood of some infinite line in space is trivial. Does that make sense?
I can specify that by, so the group is a function of space and a region.
It's a function of what type of brains you want to consider. I mean, if all of the dimensions of space time were compact, we would never even have to worry about this. There would just be some set of brains. So this is just kind of an annoyance. Right. I mean, if you wanted to consider something like one, you know, D1 brains ending on D3 brains, I don't know exactly what kind of K group you would want to consider. I mean, I don't know if even. I mean, that's an interesting thing. I don't know the answer to that. So let's now see what kind of non-trivial differences are there. What kind of non-trivial predictions do you get from the classification of D brains by K theory rather than by cohomology? Say if all the directions are non-compact and we're looking at type 2b. So the answer is not much. So for instance, if we want to look for spatially localized objects, the group to consider is the homotopy group pi 8 of SUN for n sufficiently large. Okay, and yeah, now maybe this is the time actually to say something about what people call the Chan-Payton bundle. So let's see. So it comes from string perturbation theory. You can consider open strings, okay, with endpoints that are free to sort of move anywhere in space, and that's fine. But you can also, okay, so the Hilbert space the Hilbert space of a single string sort of breaks up as a tensor product of degrees of freedom that sort of live in the interior of the open string with degrees of freedom that may live on each endpoint. And if you just say, if you just allow these to be some random finite dimensional vector space, that does not spoil the consistency of string theory. You have to be a little careful, but they have to have the same dimension for one thing, and so just looking at the Hilbert space of the endpoints, basically it's just a set of n by n matrices, and so then there's a kind of subtle, well, not too subtle, but I'm not going to go into it, an analysis of the fermion zero modes that live in the interior, And it turns out, okay, so, yeah, and Joe talked a little bit about this, yesterday, that the lightest states of the string you get are the following. You get okay. So by analyzing the fermion zero modes, first of all, you see that there are states which transform as vectors under the subgroup of SO9,1, which is fixed by the momentum of the string. And so the way we know how to get such particles in field theory is by sort of quantizing a dynamical connection on a vector bundle. These transform as the adjoint of UN, where N is the dimension of the vector space living on the endpoints. And these transform as the adjoint of the other UN. And then there's also a complex tachyon that transforms as a bifundamental. So it transforms as fundamental under one UN and anti-fundamental under the other. And it's complex. We can let the bundle whose connection we are quantizing, we can let that have any topology we want. And in fact, there's an argument that locality sort of forces you to allow all possible topologies for the bundle. And so, but that bundle is what people call the Chan-Peyton bundle. So, right. So where does that answer it?
So if you're doing this via Feynman integral, where you just wait over all possible bundles, then
you're right. So you sum over all possible bundles and over all inequivalent connections. And sort of figuring out how to mod out by sort of local automorphisms of the fiber was actually something which in physics was hard. I mean, that actually took a long time to sort of figure out how to do that. But you can do it consistently, and it works.
Am I understanding it right? Because the degree of freedom at endpoints, you have to give a vector bundle for the space time to begin with.
Yeah, well, that's right, but let's see. I mean, it is. No, I mean, the vector bundle sort of lives over all space time, but yeah, I mean, you sort of have to consider all of them, basically, because if over here you have sort of a bundle with one topology that is trivial outside of it, and then over here you can sort of put in a bundle of compensating topologies such that the bundle over all space is trivial, globally trivial. So if you allowed, say if you restricted to only trivial topology, you would get sort of non-local effects in physics, and you don't want that.
But you have to consider all vector bundles at the same time.
You have to sort of sum in the Feynman path integral over all bundles. Yeah, that's an argument that I think it's due to Weinberg that you can't just consider trivial.
When you sum more bundles, what is the action you use?
Okay, great question. So again, this is something which is just true just in effective field theory. Way prior to string theory, it was understood that quantizing connections on bundles is a good description of the observed particle physics of the standard model, the weak and strong interactions, for instance, you need to do this. So the action, the leading contribution in the action. So if you have a connection, basically that's given by, Does this notation, I mean, maybe mathematicians, like, I know you guys don't do things in coordinates, like, you hate that, but I'm trying not to have any coordinates in this talk. So, I mean, you have some connection, and it has a curvature, which is covariant. It transforms in the adjoint under local automorphisms, right? So there's a curvature, F mu nu. And then the leading term in the action is just a trace of the squares of all elements of the curvature.
Couldn't you just fix a bundle then some of all possible connections? That's not enough?
Yeah, no, that's not yet. You're not allowed just to do that, just because if you have... Let's see. Just because if you did that, then it would mean that sort of. So the most familiar example is gauge theory in four dimensions. So you can have a configuration which has sort of zero second Turing class globally, but sort of on this half of space time, it has sort of non-zero first Turing class, a second Turing class, and over here it has sort of a compensating configuration such that the total second Turing class is vanishing. And so if you only allowed trivial bundles, then the physics sort of way over here would somehow know about what was going on way over here, and that would give you non-local effects. And so we don't want that. Okay. So let's see.
Isn't choosing a bundle sort of like choosing an Compton sector, but it's almost like choosing a Taylor vacuum, and we do set Taylor. I mean,
right. Well, so what it says is that well, you can also add another term, basically trace integral. At least in four dimensions, you can do this. It's sort of special to four. You can add sort of trace F wedge F to the action.
Procedurally, what you've done is you've integrated over a fixed bundle, whether it is on number 0, or 1, or 2. Or
no, but you have to integrate over all of them, though. You cannot just sum over bundles of.
But I can consider any theta as allowed. I don't have integral over theta, right?
You can consider any relative weighting, but.
So some version of theta vacua is a specific instanton sector.
Yeah, that's right, but you can't superpose theta vacua.
I think I already sum over all
the instanton. Well, given theta, it's sum over the whole, but if superposition of theta vacua is...
That's right. But you can't superpose theta vacua. Basically, it violates cluster decompositions. Yeah, which is just another way of saying that you get non-local effects. So that's the background. So to look for new d particles in type 2b, we have to consider the group pi 8 of SUN for n sufficiently large, and that group just vanishes. So there are no new zero-dimensional D brains in type 2b, and the same goes over the same thing goes over for all pi 2k of SUN. These are all zero for large n, and I think even for all n. Is that right? but at least for sufficiently large n, they vanish. And so, right, so there are no new even-dimensional brains predicted by K-theory in this context. For odd-dimensional brains, we also find nothing new, okay, because pi of 2k plus 1, pi sub 2k plus 1 of SUN, is just equal to the integers. So this tells us that we have integer-valued odd-dimensional d-brain charges, which we already knew. They were, you know, the previously known standard type 2b d-brains, which couple to the even-dimensional p-form potentials in the bulk in the standard way. And so, well, in this context, the reason we want to consider sufficiently large n is the following. So let's say that we had a configuration of the tachyon and gauge field on say a single D9 brain anti-D9 brain pair, which was topologically non-trivial. I mean, maybe we have to make space-time topologically non-trivial to do that, right? But let's say that topological class of bundle, even though it was non-trivial, was trivial in K-theory. Well, that would mean that there would be basically virtual processes, brain anti-brain pairs that could be created out of the vacuum. And we know from quantum physics that this does happen. Okay, so we have sort of one D brain here with, say, a non-trivial topology on it, and an anti-D here with a trivial one, and say they're coincident. Right, then we could have a virtual process where a large number of D brains and a large number of anti-D brains were created out of the vacuum. Then they could coalesce. Okay. And if this bundle is trivial in K-theory, it would mean that when the brains and anti-brains all coalesced, this configuration could unwind itself and go over to a trivial one. Then the D's and anti-D's could re-annihilate, leaving you with sort of trivial topology. So, and that's the basic reason. That's really the most important point. That's the basic reason why topological charges on brains, which are non-trivial but trivial in K-theory, are not sort of fully conserved in the full quantum dynamics of the theory. So yeah, that's a great question. Right. So basically, for type 2b in non-compact space, we just get nothing.
You are looking at flat space time.
That's right.
If you have non-trivial topology, it would be very different.
That's right. I'm about to get to that. To find an example of a compactification in type 2b where there's an interesting difference between the torsion parts of K-theory and cohomology is actually kind of challenging. There do exist examples, and maybe I'll have time to get to that at the end, even though I don't actually know how to calculate it. But right, so there are space-time topologies which can give you sort of new d-brains predicted by K-theory in type 2b. But let me actually explain the missing brains in type 2b. because that's a kind of interesting story. And Joe alluded to it last week. Right. So let's carefully review sort of what Joe said. Let's keep looking at brains and antibrains in flat space time, just because this will tell us locally what happens even in a non-trivial space time. So on a brain antibrain pair, saying that this field T is a tachyon just means that the potential for it in the action, has this form. Right. So let's say m squared, absolute value of t squared, plus things sort of quartic in the tachyon. And right, this is an expansion near the symmetric point with unbroken un cross un. For now, let's think of n being 1 to start with. And then we also want this. It's believed that this potential has a global minimum and in the case of 9 brains, for instance, the absolute minimum of this potential is -2 times the tension of a 9 brain. So the interpretation is that if you have some spatially homogeneous perturbation, it causes in the case of U1, there's a single complex tachyon, and the potential looks a little bit like this. This is the gauge symmetric point. And this is the global minimum. So if you have some spatially homogeneous perturbation, it causes the tachyon field to roll down to its minimum, radiating away an energy per unit volume equal to the total energy density of the pair of brains. And so the interpretation is at the end you just have empty space with no brains or antibrains. Okay, but now let's say you have some spatially inhomogeneous perturbation. So in particular, we can perturb the tachyon in a way that sort of breaks the SO9 rotational symmetry down to SO2 cross SO7. Okay. And so the tachyon after it rolls down is going to look like this. Well, it's just by symmetry, it's going to have this form: x1 plus ix2 over root x1 squared plus x2 squared times some function of the radial distance, where f approaches what we'll call t naught, which is the absolute value of the tachyon at its global minimum. Okay, and so the point is that for this configuration to have finite energy per sort of 7-dimensional volume, the linear combination of the U1 gauge fields that acts non-trivially on the tachyon has to sort of cancel the free part of the kinetic energy of the tachyon, because the kinetic energy of the tachyon is this. So right, so far from the core of this configuration basically you want this partial theta of t plus I a theta of t to be approximately vanishing. And so that just tells us that a theta has to approach 1 over r for, you know, as the radial distance goes to infinity. Right. Now, but by Stokes' theorem, this means that there has to be a unit of magnetic flux running through the core of the configuration, the point of unbroken gauge symmetry. And so that means that the first Turing class of this bundle is non-zero. And as Joe explained last week, the Turing classes of the connection on the Chan-Peyton bundle actually define the lower dimensional d-brain charges carried by the brain configuration. So a nine-brain anti-nine-brain configuration with this topology actually carries some seven-brain charge. So now, what about even lower dimensional brains? What about like five brains, for instance? Okay, so let me skip that. So in order to do that, we have to go to stable range for pi 3, but that's just we're already there with two brains and two anti-brains. So pi 3 of U2 is just the integers. So consider two D9 brains and two anti-D9 brains. And so now we have a U2 cross U2 gauge connection. And a complex tachyon. Transforming in the bifundamental.
Why the minimum of the tachyon for a circle?
That's right, but you know that it has that the minimum of the tachyon potential has to be a circle, basically because the sort of the minimum locus of the potential has to be invariant under local automorphisms of the bundle, and so there, a local U1 action on the tachyon field has to take tachyon values to values with the same potential energy. So in other words, all U1 equivalent tachyons must have the same.
But there are more complicated radical
than doing cache. Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, that's a good question. Well, let's see. So we know there's only one complex tachyon. And I guess, I mean, I don't know what the counterexample might be. But the field space of the tachyon might be doing something complicated sort of away from its minimum, even further outside its minimum. But if we just look at this region, I think it sort of has to have this form.
But even if it had more minimum and larger, I mean, even if it did that, the argument would still be true.
Yeah. I think a single U1 orbit always has to either be a point or a circle.
But
that
could be many circles.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can talk about it later. I mean, it's believed that there's only one minimum, I think, anyway. But yeah, we can talk about that after. So let's see. Oh my gosh. So first we note that, first let's sort of look at the sort of normal vectors. Let's see, how do I say this? Let's set up a tachyon configuration which breaks the SO9 to an SO4 cross SO5 symmetry. And so now vectors normal, you know, directions normal to the core of the configuration transform under SO4. And so the trick is that we know that SO4 is sort of locally equivalent to SU2 cross SU2, which is embedded in U2 cross U2. And so let's let gamma I alpha beta tilde be the generators of the Clifford algebra for SO4. So XI, where I goes from 1 to 4, are the directions normal to the core of the configuration. So I'll just X transverse upper I. And so we want a tachyon configuration which at long distances, radial distance is large, far away from the core, look like XI transverse contracted into these gamma matrices, the unit normal separation, times the minimum value of the tachyon. And so then, by the same argument as before, in order to have a configuration of finite energy, we need the gauge connection to compensate the sort of spatial variation of the tachyon, and that forces the integral over the transverse directions of trace F wedge F to be non-zero. And as a result, this bundle has to have non-vanishing second Chern class. And so we interpret that as meaning that it carries a non-zero five brain charge. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Right. So the difference was that in the first case we considered a single brain and anti-brain. And now, in this case, we're considering two brains and two anti-brains. So, in one case, for the first case, the tachyon transformed as a plus one minus one under U1 cross U1, and here the tachyon transforms as a as a 2, 2 under U2 cross U2. So here, so the tachyon is four-dimensional, and a gauge orbit is a three-sphere instead of a circle. Is that? Well, we consider all those vacua to be essentially equivalent. I mean, we want to consider sort of configurations which are equivalent under U2 cross U2 to be really the same state of the three. Different. Yeah, I mean they're different states. The point is that you can get to a brain, a state with a single nine brain and anti nine brain to a state with two nine brains and two anti nine brains just by sort of nucleating a brain anti brain pair out of the vacuum. That's an allowed process in a quantum theory. And the reason, again, I'll just emphasize it, the reason we want to consider K-theory for classifying the charges is that we can nucleate as many brains and anti-brains as we want. And the sort of higher, the connections on sort of higher rank vector bundles will kill any topologies on the original brains which were trivial in K-theory. Does that make sense? And so this you know, generalizes to all the lower dimensional type 2B brains. And I don't have time to, I won't go into detail on that because. So now, though, I'm sort of setting all this up to see what potentially can happen unexpectedly when we consider non-trivial topologies for space-time. So let's take a very general setting. Let's take a very general setting where we have.
I have a simple question. In the case where you're considering, the bundles are trivial away from the D brain. Is that right?
Okay. In the case here, we're considering the bundles are trivial away from some fixed locus. I mean, we single out
some fixed locus.
Some fixed locus.
It's not the D brain itself that marches
itself. Well, I mean. We're starting out by considering brains which fill all space, and then on those brains we single out some fixed locus, consider bundles which are trivial over a complement of a neighborhood of that, and that gives us brains which sort of wrap that locus, whatever locus we chose. So we have some you know, general smooth manifold X, right? And again we have space filling nine brains in anti nine brains, and let's say we have some two cycle. In X. And let's call it Z. And now, if we want to use brain anti-brain annihilation to describe seven. Oh, I'm sorry, not a two cycle. Excuse me. I want a seven cycle in X. If we want to describe seven brains wrapping that cycle using brain anti-brain annihilation. Actually, the construction basically goes over pretty easily, and the reason is as follows. All we need is a single, well, no, I'm sorry, that's not quite true. But what we do is we notice we can always define some complex line bundle L, which near Z just looks like the normal bundle of Z and is trivial outside. And then we're basically done. Since the bundle is trivial outside, you can have, let's say you have a section S, which is non-vanishing. Outside a neighborhood of Z, and then we can sort of then deform it to have constant norm. So SS bar is this constant, and actually let's set it to T0, which is the norm of the minimum. T0 squared, the norm of the minimum value of the value of the tachyon at its minimum. And then choose AD9 minus AD9 bar, which is the part of the gauge connection which acts non-trivially on the tachyon. Let's choose it to be such that that S is covariantly constant outside the neighborhood of Z. And then it sort of is smooth on the overlap. So again, by Stokes' theorem, that forces the first Turing class of this combination of gauge fields. It forces the first Turing class to be non-zero, and that's the part which couples to the Ramond-Ramond fields in the bulk. And so again, we have a non-vanishing seven-brain charge. But now an interesting thing happens when you try to do five brains wrapping five cycles.
What's your definition of five
cycles? Oh, I thought there was just some normal definition, maybe not. I meant some cycle in the manifold, some five-dimensional closed thing.
Okay. Right. In space, and then you have the space-time extension.
That's right. I mean, it's just a closed submanifold of five-dimensional submanifold of your full nine-dimensional space X. Right. So we'll suppress time and all this. So something interesting happens when you try to do the same thing to construct five brains. Okay. So now you're tempted to try the same thing again. So now what you want to do is to you start out by looking for a bundle which, when restricted to a neighborhood of Z, is just equivalent to the normal bundle of the cycle Z, the five cycle Z, which is in X. So this bundle has structure group SO4, and then again outside the neighborhood of Z, we want the bundle to be just trivial. But a funny thing happens because if we try to do what we did in the flat space case, we would want to sort of lift the transition functions on the normal bundle to SU2 cross SU2, and then let the tachyon, the bifundamental tachyon, be a section of that. Okay, and that is okay as long as the SO4 transition functions lift in a continuous way to SU2 cross SU2. And if that's true, then I think that's what's called a spin bundle. Is that right? So then instead of SO4, it's actually spin. Okay. But that isn't always true. Even if it's not, sometimes you can fix it up. Because you don't have to embed the transition functions in SU2 cross SU2. You actually have these U1 factors to play around with. Okay. So let's say I'm almost over. Is it okay if I go like 10, 15 more minutes? Okay. So let's say we have a cover of of a neighborhood of Z with open sets. The open sets are U sub A. And so then we have some SO4 transition functions, transition matrices, MSO4 sub AB. These are consistent, but now, so you can sort of try just lifting them patch by patch to SU2 cross SU2. So you have MSU2, I'll call it SU2 left AB tensor, MSU2 right AB. You can try lifting those, but there's no guarantee that they will satisfy the co-cycle condition. So we'll have MAB SU2 right tensor, MAB SU2 left tensor, MAB SU2 right equals sigma ABC MAC. SU2 left tensor, SU2 right, where sigma ABC is plus or minus 1. And if it's not always 1, if you can't choose to take these square roots in such a way that all those sigmas are 1, then the bundle cannot be spin. So sometimes we might be able to sort of choose these to lie in U2 across U2 in such a way that it compensates. So in other words, we might be able to choose a set of phases, omega AB omega AC equals sigma ABC omega AC with the same set of sigmas. The condition for being able to do that, so if you're able to do that, then I think that is what it means for the bundle to be spin C. Okay. But even this condition is not completely general. But if it does hold for this cycle, then first of all we take sort of sigma omega AB squared, and if we consider those as transition functions for some complex line bundle L, then we call omega AB transition functions for an object which you might call square root of L, but in general that doesn't exist as a line bundle. It can't if you can't make those signals all unity. Mathematicians have a well worked out theory of the obstruction to the existence of such a set of phases, and that obstruction is measured by something which is it called a Whitney class or a Stiefel-Whitney class? Stiefel? Wow, I'm pretty sure. So it's known how to calculate whether or not that cycle is spin C. This is the punchline. If the cycle is not even spin C, then it seems like you can't you cannot make a five-brain wrapping that cycle from a annihilation process of 9 brains and anti-9 brains. And yeah, I mean, even though I was talking about 2 brains and anti-brains, just bringing in more brain anti-brain pairs won't help you. I mean, if the transition functions won't factorize in SU in U2 cross U2, they won't factorize in UN cross UN. That won't help you. So it seems here is a definite prediction of the statement that we classify D-brain charges by K-theory rather than cohomology, And the punchline is, it's been shown by Fried and Witten in this reference here that in fact when you try to directly study string perturbation theory in the presence of brains wrapped on cycles which are not spin C, there are actually inconsistencies, anomalies in the string perturbation expansion. What that means is there is just not a consistent quantum theory of strings interacting with a brain wrapping such a cycle.
Is that anomaly for the differential theory or for string perturbation?
It's an anomaly in string perturbation theory itself, although you can see it in the effect of supergravity, I think, with more effort. And boy, I would love to talk about the details of this calculation, but I just don't have time. Just kidding.
what is the anomaly?
So yes, so in string theory or in field theory, an anomaly is a failure of.
We don't have to know what anomaly is. Just what the anomaly is for the string perturbation.
It's a failure of unphysical fields, unphysical states to decouple from physical ones. So in other words, you don't have an S matrix. Which acts on a Hilbert space with positive definite norm. And we need a positive definite norm in order to have a consistent quantum mechanical interpretation of the scattering of strings.
Yeah. So what is anomalous in string perturbation theory?
What?
If the cycle is not spin C.
If the cycle is not spin C?
What is anomalous in string perturbation theory?
You mean like what symmetry breaks down? Right. So basically there's a symmetry in string perturbation theory which you need. You need diffeomorphism invariance of the string world sheet under coordinate transformations not connected to the identity, so large coordinate transformations. And that invariance it's a one loop, yeah. It fails in the presence of D brains wrapped on cycles which are not spin C. I think I have to stop now, but it looks like the scorecard is K-theory 1, cohomology 0. So it's the bottom of the ninth, so I should stop my talk and take questions. Thank you very much. Yeah, right. That brains which you might have thought would be there from the cohomological classification are not there. And so so I talked about this and I didn't get to talk about these. These are easier to see in type one string theory. I don't know. Hopefully, I mean, maybe one of us will be able to give another talk because that's actually interesting.
Why that lesson is related to K-theory? It's related to not being spin C.
It's related to not being spin C. But so even though you can in principle see just from string perturbation theory that in principle that string theory in the presence of D brains wrapping non-spin C cycles doesn't make sense. It's clearly easier to see in K theory. It's easier to see your inability to make such a brain through brain anti-brain annihilation. Or maybe it's better to say that was sort of how it was first discovered. The absence of D brains wrapping non-spin C cycles was first discovered by Ed Witten using this K theory argument, and then they checked it using this. No, it's real long, and I don't understand it.
Okay.
Yeah, Morton.
I guess you haven't really explained bundle explicatively. I guess you need to say something like that there is no bundle whose second churn class would be like the dual of that five cycle, or something like that. We still haven't proved. You proved that there's no brain corresponding to random that five cycle.
That's right.
So then to connect it to K theory, we need to argue that there is no K theory class, which would be that one.
Well, okay. So we showed that there was no K theory class that was represented by sort of just two brains, you know, just a vector bundle with, you know, a vector bundle with structure group U2 cross U2. Right. And so you're right. It is not completely obvious that sort of enlarging that to UN cross UN won't allow you to straighten this out, but I mean, and I haven't like proved it, but if you look at it, I mean, enlarging the ranks sort of won't help you factorize the transition functions. So yeah, that's the basic idea. Some more questions? Thank you very much.